This is Commerce Shenanigans, episode 1031, A Conversation with Judd Winnick. Welcome to the Comic Shenanigans Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Chapman. This is episode 1031. It's another conversation with Judd Winnick. If you want to check out previous episodes with Judd Winnick, well, you're in luck. There's a number of them. Actually, it's funny, on the Podbean website, when I just search Judd, it doesn't put them in order, but these are the episodes that you can try and download. I'll try and do them in order as I look at it. There's eight of them. You got episode 554 from February 2018, episode 666 from April 2019, 668 from April 17th, 2019. Then we have episode 764 from March 2020, 788 from June 2020. We've got episode 854 from February 2021. Then we've got episode 946 from January 2022. And then most recently, just in December 2023, we have episode 1019. So only 12 episodes ago. So we talked to Judd a lot on the show. He has got a new high-low book. This time it is book 10, Rise of the Cat. It was a tremendous read. I always enjoy reading Judd's work in the high-low series. So this was a lot of fun to be able to talk about. I always appreciate the fact that Judd's able to come on every year, do kind of a deep dive into his newest book. I always get a lot out of it. I hope Judd enjoys it as well. It's funny because I sometimes listen to him do other interviews and around, you know, the time of high-low releases, but you can kind of tell when someone's read a book or not, or kind of knows of the series. And, you know, we're 10 books in now, but I've been there for a long time. I was not the first adopter. I'll cop to that. I remember I was going to get Judd on the show, and I was like, oh, he's doing this with a book. And so I bought a bunch for my son, and now it's every year in February. We are very excited about having the newest release. You can jump into that. I just realized I don't even know if I introduced myself. I'm Adam Chapman, the host of Comic Shenanigans. Usually someone would do that in the first 10 seconds, not in the first 2 minutes. Thanks for downloading this episode of the Comic Shenanigans Podcast. You can email me at comicshenanigans@gmail.com, rate the show on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, listen to us on Apple Podcasts, and listen to us on Spotify. Upcoming episodes, actually next week is going to be an episode with Chris Heliopoulos, which I'm really excited about sharing. He is doing the wonderful Ordinary People Change the World books with Brad Meltzer. He's also an acclaimed letterer, so I'm really excited to share that. We actually recorded that episode before this one. I think in this episode I refer to that episode. So that's coming up. And then we also have at the end of March another Book of the Month Club. This time we're looking at the Clone Saga proper once it has started. So I think we're going to look at the first 3 months of the 90s Clone Saga. And then from there, I think in the week in between, there's going to be an episode with Pat Olive and Chuck Austin talking about Edgeworld Season 2. And I'm really excited to sit down and talk with both gentlemen again. We talked with Pat a few months ago about Edgeworld Season 2, but it would be nice to have him and Chuck in the same, well, virtual space to talk about it. Anyways, thank you for listening to me prattle on for so long. Let's get right into the episode with Judd Winnick. Enjoy. Judd, welcome back to the Comic Shenanigans Podcast. How are you today?
I am excellent, sir. Thank you so much for having me. It's good to be back.
It's hard to believe, but this is your ninth time on the show.
Well, I'm hoping that we can get up to an even baker's dozen. Let's keep doing this.
Well, as long as you keep having high-low books come out, I don't think it'll be difficult.
Then I think it's a win-win situation. I think we're going to be good. So, but more importantly, thank you for having me back on. I appreciate it.
Of course.
It's good to be back on.
So today we're going to talk about high-low book 10, Rise of the Cat, which just came out last week at the end of February, which is yet another fantastic volume. Before I get into the nitty-gritty and some of the half-spoilery stuff, what I do want to ask is, you know,
we're talking in the middle of your kind of whirlwind kind of book tour, going to different schools, et cetera. So what is it like? I mean, this far in, like this is your 10th book. I know you've said before you kind of thrive on this part of being able to interact with the actual readers and the kids who are reading your books. But how has this book tour been so far?
That's great. You know, it's all told, it'll be like a month or so. Some of it is when I'm traveling. Some of it's me back home in the Bay Area. But it's terrific. It's always terrific. I mean, the it's thing is that my readers don't necessarily get any older in front of me. they move on, they move up, and then I've got another batch are coming on in. So every year I'm talking to second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth graders, and every year it seems to be I'm still talking to second, fifth, fourth, and fifth graders. But it's great. It's always It is flattering. It is humbling. It is wonderful. Especially, nothing's better than having some kiddo come up to you with a completely dog-eared copy of your book that's being held together with duct tape and faith, and them apologize for it. And you have to explain to them, that I have to explain to them. Good old, like, I'm going to use the I'm keeping it specific. Me telling this kiddo, dude, that is the highest compliment you could possibly pay me. This is a good time. You've read this book till it falls apart. What could be better than that?
I remember a couple of years ago, I got to meet the artist Ron Friends in person because we had many interviews over the years for the podcast. And I brought him some copies of some comics to read. And he gave me this eye that said, like, oh, you have it in plastic. Like, he's like, comics are meant to be loved, Adam. I'm like, I know. But I was... At a young age, I started putting them in bags and boards. But there was a couple of the issues which, definitely had a little bit more wear. And he's like, okay, this is what I'm talking about. Like, this is what I want to see.
Yeah, it's how you do, It's how you do.
Absolutely.
With the kiddos, not a lot of books or bags in plastic.
Hopefully not.
No. They read the hell out of them, just the hell out of them. It's and that's just in the best way possible.
Absolutely. Now I have a question. So I mean, obviously, with the book tours, you're in schools, as you say, like the readers don't necessarily age. Now, how do you end up getting feedback or hearing from people who started reading when they were younger, when you started, which was obviously years ago now, who are now still with you, but now are an older reader? Like, do you hear from those types of readers?
Sure. I mean, it's, I would say that kiddos in general, they're not on social media. They, they don't have a ton of, access to email or doing that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So more than anything else, I hear from moms and dads and parents and caregivers and whatnot, that their kiddos are reading Hilo. It's usually, a parent who's reaching out that my kid loves Hilo. A lot of the wonderful talk of that they've never really taken to a series before like this, or they weren't, the ones who reach out are the ones who that reading was maybe either a bit of a struggle or not something necessarily they did, or they never really got into it quite this much before. Mm-hmm. That's what I hear from. I hear from the parents. The kiddos only when we come face to face. That's the best part.
Gotcha. Now, with the new volume, so I'm curious, I mean, obviously, when you started, you had the kind of the meta arc, or sort of the mega arc with Hilo. So that was 6 books. Then you had this really awesome trilogy with Gina. And now we're at least for this issue, this volume, we have Polly as the main protagonist. Is this part of a trilogy? Is this part of a two-parter? Can you even say? Because that would give too much away.
No, I can... I can talk about it, including just with a wrinkle. Okay, for those who are playing at home, yeah, the first 6 books revolved around our titular hero Hilo. It was all about his story. He shows up to Earth and he has amnesia. And by the time we finish with book 6, all the mysteries have been revealed and Hilo has his memory back. And then we pivoted for 3 books, and Gina was our hero, who was one of Hilo's buddies. There's 3 of them: Hilo, Gina, and DJ. Mm-hmm. So. Like any team book, which is kind of how I view it, I just kind of flopped over to one of the characters because they had a story to tell. So instead of focusing on Wolverine, we focused on Storm for 3 issues, and kind of like that. In this case, I was going to, and I still am, I'm doing a story arc around Polly, who was our anthropomorphic, you know, magical Scottish sounding cat from another world. And I've got about, let's say, four and change. I know the ending. I just haven't quite figured out the middle of what Polly's story is going to be. But what happened along the way is I got another idea, which I was just going to kind of recap in the next book, in the 11th book. And the more I thought about it, the bigger the story got. So I ran it past my editor and said, I think I want to step back away from Polly and go back to Gina and Hilo and DJ for like one whole story, and then we'll come back to them again. And so we do that. So I already broke the tradition. So even though it's gonna be a Polly story, it feels a little more seamless, which in the flopping back and forth. So we'll see. I definitely have a bunch of the story will be revolving very much around Polly, but it'll include everybody. Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. I was going to say, you know, reading this particular volume, it struck me, and maybe I'm reading too much into things, but it did feel in some ways more intensely personal than even the past nine volumes, which is saying something considering some of the emotions that you kind of went through with Hilo's story and obviously with Gina's story as well. But there's just something about, you know, the story here with Polly and then their new friend, who I guess I won't spoil too much about, but it felt very much, and again, I'm reading a lot into this, so I apologize in advance, but it did feel very present of mine. And part of this, because I just recently reread Pedro and Me, it did feel like that character almost felt like Pedro in some ways. Is that me reading too much into things?
Okay, for one, I wouldn't say you're reading too much into things. I would never say that. I will say it's... it isn't so much personal as is that we're that the story has a little bit of inside, besides the fact that we've got, like, you know, this talking cat. I mean, we're on a world full of anthropomorphic talking animals, and most of them can do magic. And this is about them going to school, which, you know, is all kind of silly and fun. In that, we are dealing with the story of an outsider who comes into this world, who isn't accepted. We are dealing with there's shades of stories of immigration and what it is to be, you know, to be an immigrant in a country that maybe doesn't want you. Those things are there. I mean, there's like five or six different things which you can't necessarily pin on one particular culture per se. And what's, you know, and that's kind of the fun of science fiction in general, is that you can tell these stories that might have some kind of social relevance within the confines of science fiction, and kind of talk and really, really get into it without it being as specific or as, you know, a particular group, person, moment, a civil rights movement, anything. So it is, I mean, I will give a little bit away that it's about robots. It's about robots and anthropomorphic animals. So, you know, with that, you know, not really something that anyone would say like, oh, this is a super political book. No, it's about robots and, you know, talking animals. So, you know, but in that, we are getting into some subjects which have a little bit more weight than one would think.
Absolutely. I mean, you have the sequence when Polly's asking their new friend about, you know, how do you put up with it and how do you handle that? And I guess that's where I read a lot into that. And so, again, if I'm happily wrong, that's fine. But like that felt more nakedly emotional and not just making a point, if that makes sense. Like that felt more real as a conversation that you may have actually had.
It was a conversation I think I'd say the collective we probably had lots of times. And without getting into it too much, it's when you're someone who is judged and oppressed for nothing except for who you were born as, that can get tiring, but there's a way of having to deal with it. Like sometimes you just have to deal with it because, there are other people who are going to have to deal with it someday as well. You have to tough it out. But it doesn't mean you like it. So that's, and I feel like I'm talking in code because I am. It's a little coded here. When you read the book, it's completely uncoded and obvious and to what we're doing and saying.
I think part of why maybe this volume is particular seemed very, you know, again, more intensely emotional to me is probably as a parent, because, you know, you have youngsters being mean to each other, and that feels like very, like everyone can kind of understand what that feels like. And right. As a parent, you hope that your kids don't have to go through that. Like, and showing the relationship between Polly and his parents, which is very warm and like very like, you know, understanding and proud of the fact that like Polly's someone who wants to help other people. And if that, you know, means that they kind of go off the beaten path, who cares? They're there to help someone in need. And that's a really strong message throughout. And I like how, you know, it's almost like society's, you know, looking down on Polly for doing the right thing, but at least their parents are in their, you know, in their corner. So again, from a parent, I really responded to a lot of that because it felt very emotional and intensely so, because I hope that my kid will want to help others, you know, and sometimes go against the rules if it means helping someone else.
Yeah. I mean, as a parent, that's what you want more than anything else, is for them to be kind, good little citizens out there in the world, right? You know, it is a basic little nightmare to find out one day that your kid might be out there bullying, mm-hmm. treating people improperly, or, you know, we're not talking about standing up for themselves. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about being awful about someone. Oh goodness, I don't know. Based on their size, their race, their ethnicity, their culture, something like that. It's horrifying. So with that, you hope and are proud of when they're well beyond that. They, you know, and they lead with kindness in their hearts. So I'm glad you think so. And I'm glad you thought it came through in the story. I am.
What I really enjoy, especially, is that, you know, Polly, since we first started having these conversations, you know, on an almost annual basis, it's obviously kind of been this fan favorite, like this fun, you know, character who kind of really does kind of jump in and out of stories, right? And so it's nice to be able to kind of check in and see what she's doing on her own world and what that's like, and see the world building and allow, you know, who was this kind of breakout character, be able to actually drive this story on her own, was really exciting. Because, you know, I always think in the kind of the idea of like TV, she's the breakout character, and now she gets her spinoff, kind of, or at least a focused episode just on them. And it does not disappoint, that's for sure.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, it's just, you know, I mean, part of it is that I've told a lot of different stories to characters, this one, I thought of it like, this would be fun. I mean, just really just like, be fun. Let's spend a little time with her. And let's see if that she could also make it through the spinoff-itis that's happened sometimes, that when a character has to become the one, the center of things, they kind of get the edges sanded off of them. And I was hoping not to do that, that she still is very, very much Polly, that she's still, you know, really brash, really loud, really unpredictable, looking for a fight. Let's hope that all still happens, in the context of this story. And I kind of feel like it does. I'm keeping an eye on that. I want it to still feel like it's the character that people really, really like. There is something to be said about, being a guest star. You get to swing for the bleachers more, you know? You get to be a disruptor. And in this, you know, a lot of it's, you know, it's around her. It's about her. Can she still be, you know, this much, this big? This broad, this big a troublemaker. That's more than anything else. This big a troublemaker. And, you know, probably. I think it's working.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting balance, as you say. And I think it's interesting having Pip there, right? Because Pip is crazier, but at the same time, like, you have not rubbed the edges off Polly. Like, she's still a firebrand. You just have an even crazier firebrand right next to her.
Yeah, I hope that helps. Yeah, but but thank you. I appreciate that you think so too. That is the goal. I think it's working.
As with most of your stories, there's always a fun, you know, a bunch of really funny gags. And definitely one of my favorites was the repeated use of the Burly Beast, how they keep getting in trouble and have to keep cleaning this Burly Beast. Which is just such a great, like, first of all, the silent panel. Well, I guess not totally silent, because you have the the sound effects coming off, but they're not saying anything. But that panel you used every time they end up back there is just pitch perfect. Like, it's so funny, especially just them not saying anything. So after every time something happens, we're right back to this panel. So it's very funny. It's a great gag. I'm curious, just from coming up with gags, what was like kind of coming up with things that they would do wrong each time that would land them in the hot water?
Yeah. I won't lie to you. That was a little bit problematic, but that was a little bit of a challenge. Because for anyone playing at home, just to set the visual scene a little bit better, we got Polly and Pippa in a boarding school. And what we have is that they are, Polly has said that they are going to, they're going to toe the line. We're going to do fun. We're going to behave ourselves. We're not going to get into trouble. And then with each just single panel, they manage to get into trouble. Then we watch them as they're literally taking their punishment. They have to wash down this like kind of giant yak like creature, which I've called a burly beast. So scrubbing it down, that's their punishment. So every time they do something good, something out of line, back to the burly beast. Do something bad, back to the burly beast. Back forth. The thing was, I struggled a little bit because one, I had to show them misbehaving mostly visually. I'd also had to do it kind of quickly. I didn't want to spend a lot of time there, a lot of shoe leather. And also, there's only so many things you can kind of screw up at school and get punished for in a way that you get blamed for. So it took me a little while to kind of gin up a few of them properly. That was a little bit of a challenge.
Well, again, it definitely works.
I joke about it often. Well, I appreciate it. You know, challenge being the word I like to go with, because the word hard. Neurosurgery is hard. Construction is hard. I make things up and draw them. That's what I do. So, you know, the level of difficulty around that is, you know, it's a challenge. I got to go with that one.
So a question, I don't know if I've really asked this before. So if I have it, I feel like I'm embarrassed that I haven't asked for the prior 9 volumes. But do you do the lettering all on your own here?
Yeah. I mean, it's a font that I got from Blambot. Called Imaginary Friend, and the lettering's on computer, as we all do. Most of the sound effects I do by hand. I do most of the book, and this is not an advertisement for that. I do a lot of it in Comic Draw, which is an app that you do that uses on the iPad, exclusively for iPad, and I love it. It is super duper easy, and I highly recommend it. Again, I don't have a piece of any of this action. None of it. I just use it. But it easily, you make panels, you do a little click and drag, and then you make panels. A real bit of magic is that you can write up a script, including if you just set it up that you basically set it up as dialogue. It instantly creates a word balloon that you can just drag and drop into the panel.
Okay.
And then you can mess with the font and change the shape of the word balloon, all that stuff. So yes, I do all my lettering, but most of the credit should probably go to the good folks at Comic Draw.
Okay. So I have a specific question about it. This sounds like such a niche question, but I'm very curious about it. And partly, so I should say, recently I had the good fortune to speak with Richard Starkings, who really opened my eyes up to the art of lettering in a way that I'd never really considered before. And then I recently spoke with Chris Eliopoulos, who obviously is a friend of yours, about lettering as well. So really kind of trying to look at it in a different way. So when I was reading your book, I was really, and this is such a small thing, how do you choose, or how much thought goes into which words you're emphasizing with the bold use? You know, you're bolding certain words. I'm very curious about the choices, because obviously it triggers something in the reader, especially like, you know, an older reader who changes maybe the nuance. Maybe a younger reader wouldn't necessarily get it in the same way. But I'm curious how much thought you put into that and what kind of process you run through.
I put thought into it. I do. It isn't something I blow past. When a word gets, for one, I bold words for emphasis a lot. This also comes from like old school comic book reading. I used to bold words a lot. And probably as I went back and read them, like in some cases, like, I don't think this works. I think it's in spots are bolding it. Like, I'm not really sure it works. And I know what they were probably doing it was for aesthetics. for me, especially when I look at a word balloon and it's all the words are one shape and size. Mm-hmm. It looks a little dull to me. It kind of looks less dynamic. And if I could drop a bolded word in there somewhere, it just has a little pop. It looks a little bit better. So I don't force the issue or anything, but given the choice of like six or one, half a dozen and the other, I'll bold a word in there because there's an aesthetic pleasingness, pleasure that one gets from looking at it when it has a little variety to it. There is an art to it, an aesthetic art to it, like that goes just beyond that. It should be incredibly legible, which it has to be. Mm-hmm. But also it should kind of look nice. I mean, sometimes I'll actually talk with the folks in copy editing and they say like, yeah, and I think we should drop that word down in the next line. And I might say, no, I like how it's centered and I like where the word sits in the balloon right now. It's just more aesthetically pleasing. Mm-hmm. And it's like, so I think grammatically, it's like, yeah, I know what you're saying, but I don't care. I don't care whatever, like, you know, sort of grammar laws that we're sort of doing here that this, you know, that it should sit better on this line and it reads better. Like, blah, 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 blah. It just looks better this way. And similarly, why I push back on copy editing now and again when they say that's not correct grammar. It's like, I know, but your way is less funny. It's just not as funny that way. So I'm not going to use proper grammar there because it just kills the joke.
Hmm. So initially, I guess, and I think a bunch of characters say it, but I know Polly does for sure. When she tells people to, you know, kind of stop it, she says shut it, but it's all one word. Is that one of those?
Yeah. Characters? Yeah. No. We in that case, we like talked about it a lot. there was some back and forth to it. In that case, I was actually asking them. I said, I feel like I kind of want it to be one word. What do y'all think? And I mean, and my editor and copy editing said, well, as long as we're consistent, I said, you look at it, what do you see? I said, no, I see shut it. And a lot of times, thankfully, everyone I'm working with is sensible enough that now and again, they fully acknowledge, like, you know what, if the kid doesn't understand this, fine, let them think about it. Let them work through it a little bit. You know, now and again, I might throw in a word that is a little bit too challenging. We sit on it for a sec and it's like, what do you think? It's like, yeah, they're not going to know what that word is, but screw it. Let them look it up. Let them ask somebody. We'll do it that way.
In the middle of the book, you have, or maybe a little bit past the middle, you have a fantastic one page splash, which you don't do a lot of a food fight. And I'm curious just how much work went into that, because there is an exceptional level of detail that you've included in this page.
For one, you're right. I've gotten away from splash pages a lot in the last several books for no other reason, but I guess like I've like, you know, I'm telling these big stories and I often feel like, yeah, I can't like give away a whole page for this. I need to do at least three panels here. And, that's not right. I should get back to doing splash pages because they're awesome. They're fun. And I've thought about, oh goodness, when I had even the inkling of the idea that I'm going to do this story about Polly, our magical cat, that's going to be on her world. She and her brother are going to go to a boarding school. I immediately thought like, yeah, we're going to have a food fight at some point. Because, you know, I'm going to draw that. They're at school. How am I not going to do a food fight? And having like one full page of just that. Anthropomorphic animals throwing food at each other. This is good stuff. You know, that's a good time.
Speaking of food, I do find it very entertaining. Yes. How many times, you know, Pip is eating something and then Polly will like be like, what are you eating? And then eat it anyway. And then just the way in which you look her, make her face look engorged every time when she shoves food in her mouth. Like, it's just a very funny recurring bit.
I appreciate that you dig, the running gag, and I'm gonna hope to not like overdo it. You know, I'll know when I've gone back to this well too many times. I try to use it as sparingly as I can, but yes, nothing. It does crack me up. It's go to joke. Like, you know, what are you eating? Like, I don't even know. I've just found it in a bag. It could, you know, it might even be dirt. Okay, give me some. You know, and they try like, that's disgusting, isn't it? And then they keep eating it. That's kind of the gag that I played nine different ways. And I'll keep doing it. I'm not going to stop. It's working for me.
Well, I do think it works on another level because it's cats, and cats do eat a lot of weird things.
Yeah, sure. Right. Yeah. You know, the fact that they're animals, they get away with a lot more, just like, you know, for what's, you know, for joke wise. And also, I think if we call it like standards and practices, which we don't have in Random House, I never have some legal beagle coming and telling me something, but they can be a little ruder. They can be a little louder. They can be a little more ridiculous, and it works each time.
True. This is a very specific question, and it's not really a spoiler, but you have a sequence where main characters are getting their grades. And I laughed at the kind of the rubric, and the last option was H for horrible. Was that a quick gag for you to come up with? Was that something you really thought about as to what would the different grade levels be? I'm just curious about the process there.
Oh, that was pretty quick. I just, for one, I wanted to come up with, you know, you got to pick a letter that's actually not used. You know, it could be A, B, C, D, and, you know, so I was coming up with letters which, you know, go for different stuff, unless it was, you know, like, you know, P for pass or whatever it was. So H for horrible just sounded funny to me. And also, you know, one always has to keep in mind the kids are reading. So you want to have clarity, you want to have absolute clarity as what's going on. You know, including that, you know, Pip got an H for horrible for behavior. And he thought he was so funny. So a silent joke that he's pointing at his grade and laughing. Yeah, they gave me an H for horrible. I do enjoy that about, that was a happy accident with Pip, that one that he does incredibly well with magic and doesn't even try. For me, I find something fun about that. There's something fun about someone who, you know, it's important to so many other people, and he just like just coasts on through. Doesn't brag about it really. I mean, he does here and there. Like, he's quite proud how good he is at magic, but it's not a bullying in a bragging sort of way. And again, I don't know. It's kind of fun that something could come so easy to somebody. Like, he's a little champ. I like it.
Your big new character is Noria, and I'm curious.
Yeah.
How many different designs did you go through before you kind of settled on the right one?
A bunch. And it always wound up being the simplest design. It feeds into it that I have to draw her over and over and over and over again. So you got to have something simple and clean. But I wanted it to be red simply. I also didn't want... I didn't want too much to be put onto the character. I mean, you based on what a character looks like, you make a certain amount of judgments. And robots are tricky. You know, sometimes they're kind of blank slates. Like a phenomenal example is like R2-D2. R2-D2's, you know, like he's there's not much there. He's like, you know, he's a trash can with legs. He's not really, you know, but with that, they make it all work and what he does and what he sounds like, you know, but he doesn't actually use words. So in this case, for me, with Noria, it was just, you know, I wanted her to look sweet, and I wanted her to look very much like a robot too, like not like another little animal or anything, like full on robot, very simple, you know, almost to the point of, I wanted her to just be just a little bit shy, being kind of dull and all unremarkable. Because she's not, because she's very remarkable. That's kind of fun.
Well, one thing that it's such a small detail, but you have the kind of the fin at the back, which is, I guess, you know, the closest you can get to Noria's hairstyle. Was that, again, an easy add, or was that something you kind of thought about, if there should be any like additional affectation?
Exactly that. I wanted just to be an additional affectation, and I avoided putting that on any other robots. We don't see a lot. But going forward, we're going to continue not to see that little bit. You know, I did dig myself a hole that she's, you know, kind of unremarkable looking. And now I got to make sure that when we have a bunch of other robots going forward, that they also have a quality to them that makes them remarkable, so you can tell them apart. That'll be a bit of a thing. I'll have to watch that.
You introduce, I guess, kind of a trope, but a fun trope, which is, you know, kind of the one friendly faculty member, which is Mr. Barmore, who has a great design. There's just something very, I mean, he looks trustworthy, if that makes sense. Like, there's just something about his design. And again, was that difficult to come up with? Like, what did you have any other animal ideas in mind in terms of kind of the friendly faculty?
Well,
or
was there... yes and no. I mean, it's, I think a lot of it is, I appreciate that you think that's working. They look like friendly faculty. That was, yeah, that is by design. You know, he's a badger. And as we know, you know, honey badgers don't play. So ordinarily they're vicious little monsters. But you make him round enough, you make him sort of like, you know, like bear-like enough. He has a roundish quality to him. And the default position on a badger's face looks like they're smiling. So he is, I just struggle a little bit, like his face would change a lot when I needed him to be serious or frowning. But I just wanted that. I wanted him to be looking like someone that you immediately like, not in just what he says, but the way he looks. It's very astute of you, yes. If he looks a little bit dangerous, off-putting, not pleasant looking, you like him and trust him less, and you almost feel like, and kids are intuitive this way. It would feel like I'm trying to tell them something that isn't there. If he looks a little spooky and acts a little, even if he acts pleasant but looks a little spooky, it's sort of like we're waiting for the other shoe to drop. You know, what might that be?
Very true. Now, in the same manner, you have Commander, I guess, Tux, who looks like an authoritarian. Like, I don't know why, what it is about how you draw these animals, but like, you're not surprised that that's someone who would go by Commander. Seems about right.
Yeah, she is tall, she is thin, she's angular, she has resting pissed off face. you know, and it's a, again, it's like, you know, she's, you know, she's basically like, she's an antelope. Which, you know, on its feet, like, well, no one thinks of an antelope as being a dick. You know, no one thinks of an antelope as being like, you know, particularly difficult or, you know, or mean, but they can look severe. I guess severe is the word we're going for here. She looks very, very sort of intolerant, impatient, unpleasant, and also a character who has, it's harder to draw her smiling. Like she does not have like a face that lends itself towards smiling. It was also by design. You know, her, she looks unpleasant. She does. She doesn't look nice.
There's as you read through the book, it's interesting. Like before you get to, you know, the new character, you do have this kind of journey with Polly first, which is, so it's almost like you're like, okay, well, this is what the book is about. And then it does shift a little bit, which is adding in, you know, another character's kind of plight and how you deal with that as well. But the fact that you have, you know, that early moment with Polly and her parents, and the fact that, you know, her dad's saying, like, you know, you want to be thought of as the best, but it's important just to do your best. It feels like a really interesting thesis for what Polly's all about throughout this story. Is that, again, pretty accurate to how you felt about kind of her hero's journey, about learning
absolutely. Whereas, you know, let's and you know, the comparison is between her and her little brother. You know, he's very, very, very good at magic without even trying. It comes to him just so naturally, but he doesn't even care about grades. It doesn't mean anything to him. He doesn't particularly care about doing well in school. He likes that he can do magic well, but just only because he just likes it. Where she really enjoys, you know, she's a little bit interested in being the absolute best. And she pushes herself really, really hard. And it sort of worked. I hadn't really had an opportunity to sort of examine, you know, that with her. Like what sort of fits with the idea of someone who's a big rabble rouser, and the first one to jump into a fight, the one who, like, you know, if you give her a nudge, she'll knock you down. But, you know, but still, like, she likes being a powerful little sorceress. She really is important to her. It's her identity. It's who she digs being. And at this point, that is gauged upon, you know, your levels of becoming like a full sorcerer. And she likes that and she wants to get there. So I liked creating a scenario where she seems overly concerned about this to the point that she's gotten beyond it. Why? Because she just found her way. There was something more important going on. It wasn't so important being at the school and being the best there. you know, there was something else in the works that she had to deal with in a real way. And I like that. And I enjoy that you like it too, sir. I appreciate it.
I also liked how, you know, your conceit to kind of keep the dynamic duo together is that, you know, Pip doesn't want to be alone. Pip sees going to this place as a challenge and an adventure, whereas Polly obviously sees it as a punishment, as, you know, going backwards and, again, not being able to be what she thinks she is, you know, and at the level she thinks she deserves, whereas Pip's just more excited for the adventure and just to be with Polly. And so, you know, he gets himself in trouble on purpose so that he will get sent to the same place, which is a great conceit and a great way of getting, you know, keeping the characters together.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, that, again, some it's fun when you, oh, it's fun when they kind of write themselves, you know, and, you know, it's, that was like, well, I'm going to send Polly to a boarding school because I want it to be, take place at school, and I want it to be a little bit of trouble, a little bit of setting, and I'll borrow the idea from J.K. Rowling. J.K. Rowling, who set the kids in boarding school, not because she had any kind of great love of boarding school, but she wanted them to be able to run around at night. and if they were going to public school at home, they couldn't do that. Whereas at boarding school, you could just sneak out. And so similarly, you know, I was going to do the same thing, but what just absolutely just cracked me up is like, well, how do I get Pip there? Like he hasn't gotten into a lot of trouble. Like, oh no, he just knocks the bucket over. He just goes and, you know, makes trouble because he wants to go with Polly. You know, and, you know, like it'll be fun to go to the bad kid school. I mean, it seems that way, but this sort of the thing that's like unspoken and there on the table is that he's looking out for her, that he overhears that she's going to be going there alone. And she might not like that. And Pip's instant idea is like, oh, the hell with that. I'll go too. You know, he doesn't care if he gets thrown into boarding school. He doesn't care. Bring it. Come on. I don't care. Come on now. So, you know, and I find it to be kind of menschy, you know, it's a little bit of a, for me, it's like, here's the cat saving the cat. You can't help but like that, you know, it's helping out a sister.
You'd use the same narrative structure that you have in previous volumes in that you do kind of jump into the action, have something happen, leave it on a cliffhanger, and then kind of jump back. So we can kind of work our way there. I think this might be the first time and I could be wrong and just misremembering, but like that, when we finally get caught up, it's like right at the end. And I think that's the first time where it's been that far into the story, unless I'm wrong.
No, you might be right. I mean, just I would literally have to check like how usually. Yeah, I'm thinking that off the top of my head, I think for those playing at home, we're talking about that. I do this whole, I always think of it like the West Wing thing. So I'm basically doing like the teaser to the episode. And then when we come out of it, we cut to 3 weeks earlier. You know, I do this in a lot of the books. I do this in most of the books. And for me, I do it because I know kiddos like it. It's a little bit like it's a little bit like a magic trick. They're always a little bit impressed by it. When they, you start off and I'll even explain to our humble listeners, we start off with our two cats, Polly and Pip. They're on a lava float, which looks like they're in a, and they're being chased by a giant chicken. And that's all you kind of need to know. So when we circle back and they're suddenly faced with a giant chicken, we all know like, oh, we're going to be in a volcano soon, you know? And as a kid, you know, it's like you're ahead of them. You're ahead of the characters. And kids like that. I think they like being a little bit ahead. In this case, yeah, I think you're right that I often do it where this pays off probably towards the first climax. You know, it kind of gets us moving towards the end of the book where this is just about the final moments where we're really, you know, we're cooking with gas at this point when it pops in and pops out.
It's not quite a DC Comics cover where, you know, the cover was basically the last page. Like, it's not quite that.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, right. Not quite doing
back
that.
In the day.
But it is towards the like the bottom of the ninth, which I guess, yeah, I don't like actually do regularly. Yeah.
So obviously, like, I don't want to spoil the ending for anyone else, but I'm just curious, in broad strokes, you have a kind of a reveal, not quite last page, but just, I think it's like the second last page, Was that always the plan? Did you think that you were going to do that later? Or was that just kind of like, no, I need to live this on a cliffhanger that's going to bring people back? Like, what was that like? Because it's interesting. You start reading this book and, you know, you're it's Hilo book 10. You're like, okay,
yeah,
do the next adventure. And then you quickly forget that it's a Hilo book. And like, and you, it's just because it's just a Polly book and it feels like a great Polly adventure. So you completely forget about these other characters. You have them briefly name checked early on because there's a kind of a flashback mention of the adventures that Polly's had on Earth, etc. And then you just kind of forget about it because you're so engrossed in Polly's story. So I'm just curious where the kind of climax came from, if that was pretty early on that you wanted to have that there, or if there was any discussion to not include them there.
Well, I think we should just talk about it. Let's give a spoiler warning here. If there is anybody here who is planning to read Hilo 10, if you're an adult human being who's reading Hilo and you want to be surprised by the ending, or if you feel that like, oh, I'm a full-fledged adult, I feel pretty comfortable that I can be spoiled by the ending and I'll be okay. Okay, because we're going to talk about the ending of the book here. Not even necessarily the things that happen in the book per se, but just the ending and it takes us there. So, all right, this is your last chance. 3, 2, 1, I'm talking about it. 3, 2, 1, talking about it. So, yes. So for the entire book, it's entirely a Polly and Pip adventure with no Hilo, no Gina, and no DJ. And this came about when I did the Polly book, book 10. And as I was hatching it, I actually threw it to my editor. I said, listen, the story I'm toying with, I can get DJ and Hilo and Gina in there, but I kind of feel like it's a better story without them. Would that be okay? And my editor, without a second thought, said, no, it's fine. That'd be great. I'd love a Polly story. Let's do it. Like, oh, okay, cool. And I did explain, it's like, yeah. So here's the thing, at the end of the book, the very, very end of the book, Hilo, DJ, and Gina show up. Literally in the last 3 or 4 pages, they show up. But so here are some fun I'm going to give away for the next book. So my plan was for book 11 was to continue the Polly story. Hilo, DJ, and Gina are there, and we're going to just take it from there. And then I was going to like do a little bit of a flashback as to what they were up to and how it got them here. And then as I started digging into it, it got a little more complicated. And, you know, what started was just like 3 pages to sort of explain where they were, you know, back on Earth and maybe what they were doing and how they managed to get to Earth, managed to get to Ocean over to Polly's world. Because where they show up in Polly's world in the end. Again, the more I got into it, the longer it got until it just clicked. I said, oh, my goodness, I think a whole book is here. I think I could do a whole book of what Hilo and DJ and Gina were doing while Polly was doing this adventure. So I just threw it to my editor. I said, okay, here's my idea. I wanted to do a story that runs concurrently with book 10. So book 10 and book 11 happen at the exact same time. And when book 11 ends, then we see how it crosses over. And I said, and I'm also going to raise the level of difficulty. Things that happen in book 10 on Polly's world are going to bleed over to what's going on in Earth. And my editor said, like, oh, this is bananas. I can't wait. Yeah, I'll do that. my editor, Shana Corey, she's always game. So book 11, there's no Polly and Pip. They just show up in the end. So we do a whole adventure with Gina and DJ and Hilo all on Earth. And it is somehow slowly related to what the story is of book 10. And then they come together. And that was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. It came together really well. I'm done with the book. I'm very pleased how it came out.
That's awesome.
The title they mentioned at the end of book 10, which is Hilo 11, the great space iguana. it takes place almost entirely in outer space, which I did not have a opportunity to do before. So this is going to be fun. Mm-hmm. And I am looking forward to y'all getting to read that one.
It's speaking of, so my son read the volume, gets to the end, looks at the next page, he's like, oh man, the next one. And he looks, 2025, which is the best response you want from a reader, right? To be like all bummed that it's that far away. But and I laughed because I'm like, Zach, it comes out every year the same time of year, like clockwork at the end of February. Like, this is just the way they come out, bud. But he was just so like ready for the next one. So, I mean, obviously that's the response you want in a reader, to be upset that it's going to be another year.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I mean, there is no higher praise than when is the next one coming out? Like, that's it. That's the ballgame. That's me. That's all you want. You know, they read this story. And I mean, you know, the alternative, you know, the flip side of that is horrendous. It's like, yeah, oh, there's going to be another one. Yeah, I might pick that up. You know, so when's it coming out next year? Okay, if I ever get there. Okay, sure.
So I have to let you go in a couple minutes because we're right near the end of our time. Every time we go through one of these volumes, I always ask about two things. One, the dedication. So this time it's kind of in the form of like an old school comic corner box. So where did this concept come from?
Well, this is it is dedicated for start. So it's dedicated to four of my closest friends, and they're all comic nerds. So it's dedicated to Brad Meltzer, Ben Holcomb, Eric Tosullo, and Barry Ween, who I named an entire series after. Mm-hmm. These are all comic book science fiction nerds. Honestly, I probably would have dedicated a book to the four of them earlier. I just couldn't think of anything fun to draw. I swear to God, I really like how do I figure out what to do with these guys to make it like not just like a picture of them. I want to do a little something that feels right. And then when it clicked in my brain, like, oh, I'll put them in the corner box. Oh, of a comic book. Oh, that's how I'll do it.
So
these are my guys.
I was going to say, what's the full name of the comic that we don't see?
For the life of me, I cannot remember. I can't remember. Ben Holcomb actually asked me, like, so what are we? Are we the Friendship Four? What are we? Because it's not even an R, it's an F. And I had something, and I couldn't remember. It's FE, and for the life of me, I can't remember. Or if I decide in the last minute just to change the letter, but it seems so unlike me that I wouldn't have a plan. Mm-hmm. So at some point it's going to occur to me, or I'll find a note written somewhere or an early sketch that had it on there, because it's gone. It's completely out of my head. I have no idea. No idea.
Was there any specific reason for the 1970? Was the, you know, the year you have here, you have the number is 126. You have it's in October, and you also have the number below it as 02461. Is there any significance to any of those details?
Okay. So the 1970 is the year I was born.
Okay.
What was it? I did it 126.
Yeah, and it was issue 126.
That might be, I got to look it up. Let me see X-Men 126. It might be because of X-Men 126. Let me look. I'm sure that's why I did it. I just want to make sure I'm right. X-Men 126. X-Men 126, which Byrne and Claremont, that came out in 1979, so I was 9 years old. And it's one of the earliest comics I remember reading, and I remember just getting knocked on my ass. I read Byrne and Claremont X-Men in real time as it came out. So that's why that one. So that the 126 is an homage to X-Men 126 back in the day. And what's the third number? What was it?
It's an October issue, and then we have 02461 just below where it says October.
Well, okay, so October 10th, 1979, that's when X-Men 126 came out. So that's the October part.
Okay.
And again, what's that final number? It's what?
02461.
02461.
Like, my first thought was 24601, which is Jean Valjean, but then the zero's in the wrong spot. So I wasn't sure.
You know, the Jean Valjean one would be like a better guess. I swear. I can't remember. Let me write it down. I'm gonna write it down so I can look at it. Give me a sec. Repeat it to me. So it's 0-2-4-6-1. Nothing. I got nothing. No idea.
I can tell you that no other interviewer is ever gonna ask you about this.
I know. And I will email you if I remember. For all I know, like February 4th, 1961, is that significant for anything? Or did I just randomly pick the numbers?
It's possible.
Is 1642 in any way significant? I don't know. I can't remember. This is sorry, folks. This is what it's like to get old. You know, and also sometimes you're in the moment just banging it out. And I can't imagine I didn't do something with that because I took so much time for it to be significant. At the same time, the comic book page that I used as like a boilerplate blueprint, that just might have been the numbers on there. And like I said, now these matter. I don't care so much about one. I don't care.
Interesting. Last question.
Yeah, maybe.
I think you've done this before. But on the last page where you have your, kind of a bio on you, you have the high-low bunch. Is that a new image or is that something you'd used before?
No, that's brand new. I do a new author page for every book.
That's right. I should have known better.
Yeah, it's okay. I switch it up each and every time. It's honestly, the one who's tickled most by these is my editor, Shana. She just loves it each time I cook something up. And I think I'm running out of places I can go and now I can one up myself. I mean, she went bananas for Abbey Road. She loved this one, the high-low bunch. The next one I don't want to give away. But I will admit I'm getting stuck. I'll have to figure out new clever ways of doing it. I'll tell the peanut gallery that at some point I'm going to do the Norman Rockwell self-portrait one. I keep putting that one off. Because to be really honest with you, I just do not want to half-ass it. Mm. And by the time I'm doing the author page, I have finished the rest of the book and I'm tired. Mm. So it's really sort of like, I don't want to roll my sleeves up that much to do this. I want it to be fun. Mm. And the Norman Rockwell one's going to be hard because for those who don't know, Norman Rockwell does a really terrific self-portrait. Where it's a self-portrait of him making a self-portrait of himself. He's painting a self-portrait of himself. And it's been done a million different ways by a million different people, from like, there's a version with Walt Disney. If you name a cartoonist, they've done it. So this is not an original one, but they've got all these accoutrements and little Easter eggs around them, which that's what's going to take a lot of time for me. All these Easter eggs all around them. So yeah, that's going to happen at some point.
And then actually, I lied. The real last question, have you already started working on book 12?
You know what? I don't want to lie to you. I haven't, but I have. Let's see. Let me explain this. So I've got a lot of ideas for book 12 cooking in my head, and they've been cooking for a while, and I got some getting it down. I am going to try to make a significant dent in a side endeavor high-low book. We are going to be doing... When I say we, I mean me, but the collective we. We're going to do two holiday books.
Oh.
One is going to be still just flat out graphic novels, same length as the ones in the series, but they're basically standalone outlier holiday books. One's going to be around the December holidays, basically, like your winter holidays book, snow, lights, gift giving, all that. So it's I don't want to put a religious spin on it. And all of our characters celebrate in their own ways, and we'll deal with that a little bit. But it's basically an adventure that happens around the December holidays. So that's the one I'm working on now. And I'm also going to do a Halloween one, which has been cooking in my head for years and years and years. And we went back and forth about both these ideas. Just could we just put them within the series? And we all felt like, let's just make them stand on their own. So this holiday one I'm doing sits between books 3 and 4. As far as the chronology. So that's, and I wanted a particular team at a particular time to be celebrating. It's before they've wrapped up things with Razor Work and all this jazz. And I'm deeply enjoying that. And I'm trying to barrel through as much as I can before I start getting myself into crunch time. And I got to get back to high-low book 12. So I've not stopped doing high-low. I am not barreling ahead with book 12 just this second.
Interesting.
Talk to me in about a month. I got about a month to really make a big dent, and then I got to get back on the stick and start turning out some Hilo 12.
It is interesting, though, because it feels like you're much further ahead than before, but maybe this is kind of why you had to be. Because it felt like before, you know, you were working on a book and it was going to come out the year later, but if you've already done, you know, 11 and it's coming out in a year, and you're, you know, about to start work on 12, it does feel like somehow, even though you're doing additional work, you're somehow still ahead.
it's knock wood. It always kind of works out that way. Is it called Parkinson's theorem? Not to do with Parkinson's disease. And let me just make sure I have it. I'm going to grab my phone so I'm not giving misinformation. I think it's actually called Parkinson's theory. Is it his? It's called Parkinson's law, that work expands to fill the time allotted for its completion. And in English, what that simply means is that if you give someone 2 weeks to do something, they'll take 2 weeks. If you give them 13 days, they'll do it in 13 days. Mm-hmm. People rarely get it done early. Basically, the way I'm putting it is that, I might have gotten it done early, but it might just turn out it's just this is all the time I needed to get it to get the next one done, to get the next one done. It's I'm always fairly right up against it. Not even up against the deadline, but it's as much time as it possibly needs. You know? A lot of years I was on the road. I was on the road inking the next book. Like I had like 50 pages that needed to get inked, and I'm doing that on airplanes and in hotel rooms and sending it in. Not this year. This year I'm done and working on other stuff.
It almost sounds like John Romita Jr.'s law, because he's always said he's a deadline artist. You know, he'll make it by the deadline, regardless. Yeah. You know, give him 5 minutes, he'll get it done. You give him three, you know, and obviously you can, you know, sometimes tell, but he's always said, like, I'm a deadline artist. It depends what the deadline is.
Yeah. No, I won't lie to you. My wife is very much the same way. She always gets it done in time, but it's got to be close. She's not a get it done early person. She gets it done. She gets it done incredibly well, but it always has to be with a crunch, just to get in there, you know, just comfortably under the wire.
Okay. You
know? Not so that anybody else is put out. That is not something she does. Like we talk about false deadlines where someone throws you something on like a Friday at quitting time and said, yep, here you go. It's like, wait a minute. I'm supposed to give you notes and send this back to you. And then we're going to send it in on Monday. That's not how this works. So she never does that. She always makes sure that everyone has plenty of time to, you know, but her own crap, man, if it needs to be done by noon Monday, 11:55 Monday, she's sending it in. That's when it's, you know, and she's smarter than three of the smartest people you possibly know combined. It's just how she's built. It's how she's made.
Well, Judd, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you have to go, but I really appreciate you coming back on to talk about Hilo Book 10. And I guess, you know, we'll have Book 11 next year, but it sounds like at some point we're going to have these other books. So more reasons to have you back.
Yeah, absolutely, sir. And I am, and it's going to be back, and I am quite thrilled that Comic Shenanigans is back full steam ahead. I appreciate it. It's fun to listen to, and it's especially fun to be on. But I'm a fan, so I'm glad it's back. So thank you, sir.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.